The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Hopkins has found that lockdowns have had little public health effects, but have had a major negative impact to society as a whole.
Bombshell report that confirms what a lot of skeptics thought. The lockdowns for COVID didn't work. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University say the lockdowns had little or no impact on COVID deaths, and maybe even made things worse. They say shutting down the country prevented just 0.2% of deaths. A researcher's writing, we find no evidence that lockdowns, school closures, and limiting gatherings have had a noticeable effect on COVID-19 mortality. In fact, they say limiting gatherings in outdoor public spaces actually increased COVID mortality because people then gathered inside instead.
Dr. Amish Adalja, who studies infectious disease at Johns Hopkins. The study, Doc, came from Hopkins. What do you make of it and how conclusive is it?
I think it kind of backs up these blunt tools like lockdowns because of the way they were instituted and because of what they included, what they didn't include, because of people's compliance, because of people doing things that were kind of more risky but underground, for example, gathering indoors at someone's house and eating outdoors. We're not going to be that effective. I think politicians want a quick and easy solution, and that's what they're going to reach for. But what we need to really instill in people is that it should be targeted, precision-guided, voluntary guidance to people so that they can learn how to navigate risks, to know what's more risky, what's less risky. Because, for example, if you're telling people they can't go to a park, it makes no sense based on transmission. And at the same time, you're not actually taking the effort you need to do to stop mortality by, for example, fortifying nursing homes. Instead, many governors did the opposite with nursing homes.
I wanted you to help put in perspective the study and these statistics. States with strict lockdowns versus states with loose lockdowns. This is total deaths per 100,000 people. The non-lockdown states did far better. Is that what we're seeing in this data?
I do think that states that were less stringent with their lockdown policies did a lot better than most people predicted. Clearly, Florida and Texas, for example, did a lot better than other states. And I think that's something that needs to be explained. In places like New York City, where they were really worried about the hospitals being able to survive, they had to do something in order to pull a circuit breaker so that those hospitals didn't get crushed. But what happened is many governors across the country just extrapolated what was going on in New York City and then had an indefinite type of lockdown, which wasn't driven by metrics, and it didn't necessarily work, and it didn't actually do the things they needed to do, which was work on nursing homes, get testing stood up, get people the ability to understand which activities are more risky and less risky. All of that is something that I think we have to go back and revisit. And many of the policymakers were kind of going off of infectious disease experts, telling them what will decrease cases, and it's up to those policymakers to be able to weigh all of that and say, what are the long-term consequences of this? Is this sustainable? What are the negative cascading impacts we're going to see with schooling, with other medical care, with people's mental health and substance abuse? And that's something where all of our governors basically abdicated. They didn't know what to do. They didn't think about, they didn't think long-term. They just panicked. And I think that's what we have to really get over, because there's going to be another infectious disease emergency. And we have to get our policymakers up to speed to take this seriously and take the correct action, not just take any action.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The national debt crosses $30 trillion this week, as the debt is now growing at almost $400 billion a month. Interest rates also move sharply with higher inflation rates, with the 10-year note crossing over 1.9% on Friday as the job numbers came in much stronger than expected, raising speculation that the Fed is getting more hawkish. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Frank Barbera joins me at the top of the hour. Frank believes the markets are caught in a narrow trading range. The S&P needs to hold 4450 to 4460. Breaking that level could lead to a sharper downturn. Daniel DeMartino Booth also joins me later on in the program as we look at what the Fed may or may not do this year. Truth be known, nobody knows at this point whether it'll be two and done or as many as seven rate hikes. The flattening yield curve would suggest only two hikes this year. Finally, in today's program, Chris Poplavin and Chris Sheridan will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Well, it's been a long time since I've seen investors influenced by company earnings enough to steer the macro picture as much as it has this week. Investors took their cues last Friday after Apple's earnings and outlook gave investors a view that maybe companies can maintain their growth while managing the increases in costs that we've been seeing. Apple also highlighted the company could see easing constraints on its supply chain in the March quarter. This combination led to a rally from oversold conditions that continued into this week. Monday's rebound continued where there had been the most technical damage in growth and small cap stocks. The rebound was helped by some analyst coverage of growth stocks that caused Netflix to close up 11%, Spotify up 13.5%, Beyond Meat up 15%, and Tesla up 10%. Earnings helped Tuesday as well with better than expected earnings reports from ExxonMobil and UPS, which both closed positive on the day. And after the close, Alphabet also reported better earnings and announced a 24-1 stock split, which sent the stock up 7% the following day on Wednesday, which is being speculated there might be potential to be included in the Dow Jones Industrial Average at some point, again, for Alphabet. The bulls almost lost their edge on Wednesday by news the U.S. was sending 3,000 troops to NATO countries near the Ukraine and a drop in ADP private payrolls in January, but the rally continued despite the news. On the tech side of things Wednesday, PayPal finished down almost 25% on disappointing earnings results and guidance, while Advanced Micro Devices was able to close up 5% on their earnings. And maybe because of moving so quickly off the lows from last week by Wednesday, or also facing significant resistance levels, the market turned down on Thursday as a result of Meta Platforms, formerly Facebook's, earnings, which missed estimates and issued downside guidance on revenues for the quarter. With that news, other earnings announcements from Qualcomm, Merck, Honeywell, and Spotify helped the NASDAQ close down 3.7% and the S&P 500 down 2.4%. Taking a deep dive here into Meta Platforms' earnings, the privacy changes to Apple's operating system are still problematic for the company's advertising business, which Facebook estimates to be a problem of about $10 billion in revenue this year. There was also some commentary from the company that it may be losing on market share to YouTube and TikTok, which it feels contributed to its drop in monthly active users. Meta doesn't see any relief on the Apple privacy changes or current competitive landscape for ad revenue, but believes building out the metaverse will be its game changer, but that may be years away. Amazon and Snap were able to help bulls bounce back on Friday. Let's say that 10 times fast. With Amazon set to raise Prime prices and Snap's nearly 60% rise in stock price on standout results that show the social media titan Meta Platforms may be suffering from company-centric issues. In the prior day's trading, Snap was down nearly 25% on those concerns expressed by Meta Platform about Apple's privacy changes. It was Snap's first year and first GAAP quarter of profitability. Revenue grew 42%, surpassing guidance. Daily active users were up 20% year over year to 54 million. And lastly, the company provided guidance 37% higher for revenue this coming quarter rather than estimates. Moving away from earnings, economics reports weren't as cheerful. The ISM Manufacturer Index for January decelerated to 57.6 amid Omicron-related disruptions. And the ISM Non-Manufacturing Services Index also decelerated in January to 59.9, with similar Omicron and supply chain issues being highlighted in the report. Factory orders in December decelerated 0.4%, but inside the report, there was some growth for non-defense capital goods, excluding aircraft, a proxy for business spending. The private ADP payrolls dropped by 301,000 jobs in January, while the Bureau of Labor Statistics payrolls report Friday showed an increase of 467,000, with the revision to December as well up to 510,000 from 199,000. Unemployment ticked up 4% due to a rise in the participation rate to 62.2%, and average hourly earnings were up as well 0.7%. Lots of chatter from Fed speakers this week, but none of which really moved the narrative of uncertainty around the first rate hike being possibly 25 basis points to as high as 50 in March, especially after the strong jobs report for January and the uncertainty around really what the glide path for interest rates will be and what that will look like throughout the year. The Bank of England fired off its second 25 basis point hike, acknowledging inflation, while the ECB this week has said it won't rule out a hike after previously stating it was unlikely. At the end of the week, the NASDAQ gained 2.4%, the S&P 500 up 1.6%, the Russell 2000 Small Cap Index up 1.7%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1.1%. 8 of the 11 S&P sectors closed up, with energy up the most, up 4.9%, leading, followed by consumer discretionary up 3.9%, and financials were up around 3.5%. The three that were down, they weren't down very much, but that was materials, real estate, and communication services, down by maybe 3 basis points each. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Earnings primarily driving the markets, and it's really nice to see that. It's been very refreshing to see the change in pace from some of the macro news around the Fed to focusing on what's going on at the company level. That's it from this wrap-up report. On to the technician for this week.
Rick Mills is an expert in the resource mining sector, as well as the author of the widely read Ahead of the Herd newsletter at headoftheherd.com. And Rick, there's been a lot of talk about the global supply crunch and the shortages that we see for oil and natural gas. But tell us about the global supply crunch that's currently underway for battery metals.
When you look at electrification and decarbonization, which are similar themes, they're global or ongoing, they will be going on for the foreseeable future. We rushed pell-mell into the electrification and renewable energy. While we no longer are allowed to mine in our own countries, say Canada and the U.S., stiffer regulations, you know, NIMBYism is coming to its forefront. And even when we do start mining for these metals and minerals, we find that we have no smelters or refineries, and we don't have the manufacturing capacity to make anything anyway. Most of it's been shipped overseas. And it's not that there's really a supply shortage. It's the fact that China controls almost all the processing. We basically switched one energy master for another.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, after a couple weeks of falling down, stocks are starting to rally. But is this a dead cat bounce? Well, is the correction over, or is more damage to come? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Frank Barbera. Frank, let's take it from the top, looking at the major indexes. It seems like everything has been in a rally mode. And for the NASDAQ, which got hit the hardest, it looks like it's trying to make its way back. What's your take here?
Well, Jim, I think that's precisely correct. And even though we are, as we're speaking today, the S&P is down about 68 points on a big drop in Facebook, which was really shocking to Wall Street on an earnings report. Nevertheless, the S&P, it's about 45.20 as we're talking. And I would say there's some pretty good support underneath the S&P around 44.60. And I would say in the short term, that area, that 44.50, 44.60 area is likely to hold. And I wouldn't be surprised to see this market rally up and make higher highs above yesterday's highs. It's possible the S&P could rally back as high as the low 4,700 area before it sort of runs out of gas in the short term. The NASDAQ, the QQQ, which is around 358 right now. 380 was a number I was looking for as an upside target on the QQQs in the short term. And at 358, the equivalent short-term support for the QQQ is around 353. So I think the market is still in a short-term uptrend that probably has a bit further to go. After that, I think the rally will exhaust over the next, 5 to 10 days, and we'll see a bit of a pullback, probably get some grinding sideways behavior where it's in a fairly narrow range. The big support on the Qs is 350, and the low 380 areas is big resistance. On the S&P, the big support is about 4250, and that 4740 area looks like it's going to be strong resistance. So I'm really thinking that this market is actually moving into a trading range environment for a while. And that trading range environment could either be a big top that's being constructed, some kind of distribution pattern, or it could be a consolidation pattern. I think the truth is we just won't know for a little while longer. So people should get used to erratic swings. But as long as the S&P is holding up above the 4280 support area, and the NASDAQ, the QQQ, is not breaking materially below 350, I think it's a safe bet to say that the trend has now gone flat from up and that we're in some kind of giant sideways period yet to be determined.
So, Frank, when you look at some of the alternatives, which obviously is the bond market, we've seen credit spreads begin to widen, especially in the area of junk. But if I'm looking at treasuries, looking at two-year notes, let's say 7/8 of a percent, then you're taking a look at the 10-year note, which is a very little in terms of yield. What competes with stocks?
Well, it's definitely still that TINA environment. There is no alternative. That's the truth. Although, JP, I would point out something intriguing. And this is, I want to make the audience understand, this is not to be misconstrued. Okay, so when I look at the bond market right now, the 10-year and the 30-year both look like they're beaten up enough so that we could see, a 2 to 4 month trading rally in bonds. There's some really interesting things. If you look at the IEF, for example, which is the 10-year ETF, that just broke down in the last 3 to 4 weeks below lows that were made 6 or 7 months ago. Okay, so the 10-year price made a new low as yields made a new high. No great shock in any of that as inflation has been very high. But if you look at the 30-year bond or the 20-year bond, the TLT, which is a long-duration bond, as the IEF went to new lows, the TLT did not go to new lows. So there's a positive, at least a potential positive divergence there. I track dollar puts to calls on the TLT, and the readings there have shown as much negative fear as you've seen in a very long time. So it also high-grade corporates, LQD, medium-term 50-day RSI, which is, it takes a lot to push that indicator around. That has checked in with major oversold readings over the last 2 weeks. So I'm actually, for a while, I was completely out of bonds. It's been months since I've been anywhere near bonds. I've put a small position back on, and I'm going to be watching them, especially through tomorrow's non-farm payroll data. I think one of the possible positives that could be coming in the bond market is the fact that the economy is now slowing down. We see clear-cut signs of a pretty serious slowdown getting underway. This morning, factory orders were down 0.4%. That's come in from an annual rate of change up around 34% year over year. That was a peak back in April 2021. We're now down to just a 13.3% annualized rate of change on factory orders. You're seeing weakness in service sector. Again today, an 18-month low on the market U.S. service sector index. That's the lowest since August of 2020. Weakness in the J.P. Morgan and Citicorp Economic Surprise Index, and weakness in an entire cross-section of consumer confidence indices. So I think the high prices that we've seen, the gas pump, food prices, what they say, the only real cure for high prices is higher prices. And at some point, the higher prices just bite into the wallet and consumers pull back. And I think we hit that inflection point. And now what we're seeing is this consumer retrenchment setting in. And I know JP Morgan, and it was Goldman Sachs the other day, cut their first quarter growth estimate to just 0.1% growth in GDP, which is just shocking. So it looks like we might be flirting with a negative growth quarter in the first quarter. Most companies, most Wall Street firms are looking for a rebound in the second quarter. So if there is a rebound in the second quarter, we wouldn't be in a recession. But I do think a slowdown is in place. You have this sort of stagflationary environment where prices are still high, but growth is slowing. So there may be some room for bonds to have a rally. But beyond that, I'm sort of with you 100%. I think over the next 2 years, 5 years, and 10 years, bonds are going to go back to what they were in the 1970s, which the old term was certificates of guaranteed confiscation. So if you bought a bond, you know, basically you're going to lose money.
And, you know, the other thing I'm looking here, Wall Street is all over the map, Frank, when it comes to how many Fed rate hikes. You know, you've got Bank of America that thinks it's going to be 7. Others think it's going to be 5, 4. But if you look at the yield curve, you take a look at the spread between the 2-year note, which is 1.19, the 10-year treasury at 1.82. Frank, the spread is only 63 basis points. The Fed's got to be careful here, or they're going to invert the yield curve, which is recessionary, because you know what that does to credit and bank lending when you have an inverted yield curve.
That's exactly right. And I think on the 2s and 20s, it's even closer than that. So you're really talking about a very flat, virtually inverted yield curve right now. And that's a warning. That's a warning of a slowdown. So, you know, then I think the big question out there, Jim, that we're really flirting with is one of leverage. When you look at the amount of margin debt that exists in the stock market, it's huge. When you look at the stock market as a percentage of GDP, it's 200% of GDP. So you have a $49 trillion, $50 trillion stock market, maybe a little less today with the collapse in Facebook, but very large stock market against a $23.1 trillion economy. And so here's the point. If the stock market drops 10%, that's $5 trillion. Well, that's the size of like the Italian GDP, right? It's taking like a country the size of Italy and just poof on its way to Pluto. I think the Fed is very concerned about triggering a major bear market in the stock market, because the consequence of a bear market in terms of negative wealth effect would be huge. So my hunch is that they're going to really tiptoe about raising interest rates. I think they're scared to raise interest rates. And I think a lot of these forecasts of four to six rate hikes a year, I mean, this year, are probably not going to be, I'd be surprised actually if they go one and then something doesn't happen, and given the leverage. And that's what you have to actually watch, is the fact that there's so much leverage in the stock market in the way of margin debt. I think if the market has an event, the Fed will crack very quickly and revert right back towards easing, or they will go on a very long pause. That's just my guess.
Well, you know, the amazing thing, and this has got to be disturbing, Frank, the government's fiscal year ended in September, and we were about roughly about $28.5 trillion in debt. In 3 months, we added $1.2 trillion to the national debt. The debt is growing at $400 billion a month. We are now over $30 billion. So, Frank, if we had interest rates, as some are predicting, that the 10-year would go to 2.5, some are saying even 3, a 1% increase in government financing cost adds another $300 billion to the deficit. I mean, at some point, the Fed's got to be looking at this, and the government's got to be looking at this and say, no, we need you to start pumping money again, because we're putting out a lot of money.
That's exactly right. They're in a, what's called a fiscal debt trap. And I agree with you completely. I think there's almost no way out of it. This is a situation where the die is cast effectively. And it's one reason it really brings me back to gold and eventually to silver. Now, just like right now, I'm saying I think bonds could have a rally of 3 to 4 months. And not a big rally, but let's say, for example, on the 30-year, I think you could drop from 220, which is resistance, down to like 170, so maybe 50 basis points. And on the 10-year, the 190 area is resistance. You could get down to like 135, 140. Gold does not look like it's ready to go just yet. And long-term listeners will know, you know, that as the gold stock technician, I've been a pretty big bull on gold. But gold at 1807, you know, is it needs to hold support at 1780. But I think there's a pretty good chance it's going to test 1700 again in the next few weeks. That could be a more interesting low. Right now, I think gold is fighting the headwind of all of this Fed speak about tightening, at least the outward pivot to look like they're trying to fight inflation. That's something of a headwind because it's become so embarrassing that the Fed has been behind the, you know, so far behind in the game. They should have been tightening a long time ago, and inflation really was not transitory. It looks very much embedded at this stage of the game. And I think ultimately, the tightening cycle that we're in, you know, it's going to look very weak. You may have like one hike or maybe two hikes, and then the stock market won't like that. And at some point, then the Fed will reverse and go back to some kind of quantitative easing again instead of quantitative tightening. They'll start printing money. And the problem with that is that they're going to be starting an easing cycle from effectively almost zero interest rates. And so you wonder, what is going to be the efficacy of that easing cycle? Are they going to have to print massive amounts of money to get, you know, even some bang for the buck? And I also wonder about market rejection. At some point, may the market just say, listen, you know what, you guys are printing all this money. It's going to find an outlet. It may not be in rising rates, but maybe it'll be in a selling of the dollar, or it could be an explosion in the gold price. But somewhere in there, I think money is going to vote with its feet and say, okay, this is just bold-faced monetization. We're checking out of the hotel.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you look at where we are right now with the inflationary cost, and Frank, I'm looking at just what's going on with the consumer. You know, we've got inflation running at double digits, in my opinion, although the official rate is 7%. But you can see this reflected in the S&P sectors. You've got consumer discretionary, looks like it fell off a cliff. And you're seeing a change in consumer behavior, whether it's retail sales. And the thing you wonder about these kind of situations, the confidence of consumers is very fragile. You know, they're seeing the inflationary costs, but as long as the stock market's going up, you're thinking, well, I got to pay more for a ribeye, but you know, my 401k's up. What happens when the 401k starts tanking? And then the other thing, when we look at oil prices, there's not a damn thing the Fed can do about oil. The only thing the Fed can do about oil is to kill the economy.
Now, that's exactly right. And they may not have control over that. You could have geopolitics could come along and play a big role in that with the situation in Ukraine or the situation in Taiwan, or, and I would even add, the situation with Israel and Iran. I think actually of those three, the situation with Israel and Iran is probably the more dangerous of the three. That's not what's in the headlines right now. There's a lot of focus on Ukraine. But, you know, I think with the troops where Putin has the troops on the border and the fact that Germany is very heavily dependent on Russia for its gas supplies, Germany is a big component of NATO, and they have basically punted. So without Germany really turning back on Russia, I think what you're really seeing is a setup for Ukraine being the victim of some kind of internal coup fermented by a hybrid war, something along those lines. I have a feeling that Putin is trying to get what he wants without having to actually roll tanks across the border. The same situation might actually end up developing with China and Taiwan. I think the one you have to worry about is Iran with the nuclear bomb, because they're moving along pretty quickly. And I think even if we're kind of tacit on that subject, I don't think Israel will be. And I think that's where, you know, a preemptive move on Israel wouldn't be something that would be too much out of the question. So I think that may be the bigger of the three hotspots. It's just not being talked about. That's one reason to keep a close eye on the gold market at all times, and maybe just have a little, even if it's going down for a while. But I agree with you. I think equities have been the great shield at the moment, helping folks kind of try to cope with the inflation. I mean, at least for people who have some savings, they've probably got some market in there, money in the market, and they've been looking at that, saying, okay, the market's going up, I'm making a little money here, this is costing me more. But I think if that's where the risk is, if the market takes some kind of sudden turn down, then that could really feed into the weakening trend in consumer confidence that we see right now. I mean, you look at all these surveys, you know, is it a good time to buy a home? Is it a good time to buy a major appliance? Is it a good time to buy a car? And all of them are at record readings of no. And these people are just intimidated to make big purchases. And that tells me that the economy is very vulnerable. And to me, the stock market, I have to say it, the technical readings I've seen in the last few weeks, that really serious break we saw in the NASDAQ about a week ago, Monday, generated technical readings that were so oversold. I mean, we pushed RSI, some of the RSI gauges down into very, very deep oversold territory. That's not typical, really, of a bull market. So it's more indicative of a bull market top, some kind of distribution pattern taking place. And I do think a top would take a while to form. The stock market doesn't usually make sharp U-turns. And you're seeing a lot of breadth deterioration. Some of the big sort of bellwether issues really getting hurt. You know, on the NASDAQ, a lot of stocks are down more than 50%. And, you know, you're even seeing some shocks out of Facebook and the like. So I'm concerned that the market is building a top. Maybe it'll hold up through May. But I think as we get to the second half of the year, there's a 20-year cycle that's due to bottom late this year, the second half of the year. And every time we've been in that place, you've had serious declines in the second half of the year. So I think there's building risk in the stock market. I'm playing it very conservatively. I've got staples, I've got utilities, I've got some medical office building REITs, and so basically very, very, and some MLPs, because the MLPs have very high yields. And as midstream, they're not as dependent on crude oil. So there may be a little bit resistance to, in terms of being cyclical, some kind of a slowdown. And that portfolio has been working really well over the last few weeks. And I'm just trying to stick with that. It's balanced between defensive and cyclicals, and it's throwing off around 4.5% in yield. So, but I think, and you sprinkle a little bonds in there, and maybe you've got something that can do well for 2 or 3 months. But I'm kind of worried about the stock market after May.
Yeah, I just don't think, as Wall Street thinks, that the Fed is going to get aggressive. I don't think they're in the position to get aggressive, given the amount of debt, widening spreads, and, you know, they get themselves into an inverted yield curve where it really hurts the credit markets and bank lending. Then they've got a real problem on their hands. Well, listen, Frank, as we
JP, I call that a Wile E. Coyote moment. That's when they realize they're over the cliff and they start looking down.
What the hell did we do?
Exactly.
So given this, you're defensive. We're in energy, commodities, healthcare, and utilities as well. And energy has been the big star performer. That's why I still see oil prices going up, because of lack of investment.
which is one of the issues that we're dealing with now. I don't think OPEC is going to be able to produce the amount of oil that everybody wants in terms of economic growth and what we're consuming. But given that, if our listeners would like to find out more about your newsletter and the things you do, Frank, how can they do so?
Sure. Thank you so much, Jim. They can just right now they can send me an email at frankbgst@aol.com. You know, in the weeks ahead, I'll be bringing back the Gold Stock Technician newsletter. And if anybody would like to take a look at that, I'd be more than happy to send them a copy. Thanks so much, Jim.
Well, Frank, I'm not going to let you go. This, you know, tomorrow is Friday. I know you're not, you guys are masked up in LA and you're not going out. So what's on the BBQ?
Oh yeah, the old BBQ. Yeah, that's hey, I've got my favorite burger keyed up. You know, good burger. I like them with the spicy jack cheese, a little avocado on the top. I'm a happy camper, so I've got a game plan.
Okay. Well, listen, Frank, take care, my friend. We'll talk to you again next month.
After a brief but small dip, natural gas prices in Europe and elsewhere are now skyrocketing back higher. Adam Rosenzweig, managing partner at Gehring and Rosenzweig, discusses why this is a major problem for Europe and what most green energy advocates miss when it comes to how higher energy prices feed through to inflation, since today's modern economy is highly dependent upon cheap and widely available fossil fuels. Here's a clip of what he told listeners.
Prices have really exploded and people are going to be shocked when, you know, the price of wind doubles in the next, you know, 18 months, or the price of solar goes up 60-70% in the next 18 months. Why? Because the energy cost that drives all that is going up.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, one of the big debates on Wall Street is how many Fed rate hikes this year. They range from 3 all the way up to 7. Joining me from Quill Research is Daniel DiMartino Booth. And Daniel, Wall Street's all over the map on this one. From 3 to 7, there's normally you tend to see everybody coalesce around a certain number, 3 rate hikes, as was, let's say, the case in December. Now that's changing. What's your view?
It's changed dramatically. And I think the reason you see such a disparity in views is that nobody knows what's going to happen. And nobody can assess right now the quantitative value of balance sheet runoff versus the old playbook of each quarter percentage point rate hike equates to this much slowing in the economy. The only guidepost that I've been using and tweeting about nonstop is the yield curve. The difference between the most visible to investors is the difference between the 2-year treasury and the 10-year treasury yield. The difference between those two is sitting at about 0.6 percentage points. And that implies, with all due deference to everything Fed speakers and Wall Street is saying, that implies 2 rate hikes. And that is why you're savvier Fed watchers and your voters also are talking about rolling off the Fed's balance sheet as a substitute for rate hikes, because the Fed cannot invert the yield curve without purposely putting the U.S. into a recession. As it stands right now, it looks like they're inadvertently trying to help the U.S. economy into recession, given so many signposts suggest that it is already slowing and slowing rapidly.
Yeah, that's the thing that strikes me. Normally, you would see the Fed raising into a rising economy. Now we have a slowing economy. Daniel, what are the chances they actually get this right? We have a saying here, they'll raise rates until they break something, which they usually do.
Well, that's a darn good question. I mean, we came into this episode talking about junk bond yields that were, on an inflation-adjusted basis, negative. So when you talk about don't break anything, in an environment of unprecedented overvaluation across your risky asset spectrum, I would say that it makes it that much more challenging for the Fed to engineer a soft landing, and the yield curve is telling them that they have very little latitude to do so, in addition to not just the US economy slowing, but that of the rest of the world. We forget that in 2000 and 2015, there was a global industrial recession, and that at the time, Chinese policymakers were willing and capable of injecting sufficient stimulus to take the global economy out of its industrial recession. That's not happening in 2022.
So the feeling is once they raise rates a couple times by mid-year, you know, volatility will be over, inflation will be calming down, the supply chain issue will be resolved in a better second half of the year. I just don't know if I buy that, given what I see happening with energy, number one, and number two, what's happening with this tight labor market. What's your view?
Well, I do think that the Fed does not manage a soft landing. We will see what we have seen for the past 3 months, and that is a small increase in the labor force participation rate of those who are 55 years and older. Very few people are talking about this, but there is a certain reality about saying, I'm leaving the job force with $300,000 or $400,000 in hand that's going to last me 4 or 5 years. And wait a minute. I just said 4 or 5 years, not 40 years. So there's going to be some reality checks as the reality of fixed income settles in for early retirees who are getting these reality checks at the gas pump, at the grocery store, with their winter heating bills, with their potential rents increasing. So I think that we will see an increase in labor force participation that will take some of the edge off of wage inflation. That has nothing to do, though, with the most visible inflation, and that is of energy, which does not look to be coming down anytime soon. That's very problematic for policymakers at the Fed. The same can be said for President Biden. He executive ordered USDA study that resulted in a 25% increase in food assistance for the only 42 million Americans who collect it, just more than 10% of the population, which started on October the 1st. That is an idiosyncratic input to food inflation that is unique to the United States. That's problematic for the Fed, also out of its control. And even though we are seeing inventories rise and inventories rise across the board as companies segue, and this is not a good thing necessarily, from just-in-time to just-in-case inventory management, holding inventory is not free. You have to talk to somebody who's over, you know, more than 60 years old to understand that, because we've long since shifted over to the Japanese way of thinking that inventories are not going to be a cost item for companies. But even as the supply chain disruption comes off its high boil, we still have the Longshore Union on the West Coast that's got a contract expiring on June the 30th. They've gone on strike every single year since 1990 when their contract is up for renegotiation. So we could theoretically have freight prices staying high, even as companies sit on expensive inventory.
Well, it gets even worse with that, Danielle. In our state, they are now going to start ticketing truck drivers for pollution. And they're requiring, if you're bringing a diesel truck into the state, it be of certain vintage. It's got to be 2011 or newer, or have modifications to it. So a lot of truck drivers are just bypassing the state. So, you know, what's going to happen then?
Well, hopefully the drive to the Rhode Island state line is not too far.
One of the things that also concerns me, I'm looking at my Bloomberg graph of the U.S. government debt. We're at $29,924 billion. And it, you know, we were at, what, $28 trillion at the end of the government's fiscal year in September. It's almost going up at $300 or $400 billion a month. What's going to be the impact? You know, if the Fed starts raising interest rates, a 1% increase in what the government pays for debt, that's, Danielle, that's $300 billion in interest.
The sensitivity of U.S. interest expense is acute, and there's such little appreciation for that. The same could be said of how sensitive the housing market is to rising mortgage rates. There's such little appreciation. And that also goes back to the idea of Fed voters focusing on rolling off the balance sheet and tightening that way instead of the blunt instrument of raising interest rates.
So when you look at the tools that they have, whether it's raising rates, rolling off the balance sheet, as you look at this going forward, what are the chances that they avoid breaking something? I mean, they're not very good at this. And I wonder what happens if the Fed panics, if they see the markets go down 20% and the LEI start to roll over, do they panic?
Well, the Fed has been a reactionary institute, but they tend to react after the fact. So if they were going to be preemptive, they would have gotten out of the mortgage-backed securities quantitative easing QE business 9 months ago, 12 months ago. So in the sense that they're already behind the curve, if they do react to some kind of a massive fallout, and trust me when I say 20% in the major indices would be felt as being massive. So, but if they were to try and react by then, to use your phrase, something already would have been broken.
And so usually, as you point out, they react to something. Either the economy goes into recession, the stock market goes into a bear market, and then they reverse course. Now, the last time they reversed course, we weren't even in a recession. The economy was slowing down, the stock market had corrected, and they brought interest rates down to zero. How quickly do they react this time? Because there's greater elements that are out there today that they could find themselves in one heck of a bind here shortly.
Well, they could, because interest rates are already so close to the zero bound that they only have the balance sheet to turn to during a midterm election year, when it's patently apparent that they're not going to get a big boost from the fiscal side, which was the largest in post-war history in the immediate aftermath of the pandemic. So the Fed is kind of going at it alone without a big potential for fiscal stimulus, without interest rates to take down because they're already so low. And the only avenue that they would have would be to continue growing the balance sheet from its $9 trillion level. Very difficult, very few choices.
And the other thing, you still have Washington that hopes to get some kind of additional spending bill. The idea, if you get the additional spending bill, according to the administration, will help bring down inflation. I don't buy that argument, but they're still talking about spending more money.
You know, they are talking about spending more money, but the type of stimulus that's being pondered is kind of your old school infrastructure spending that would benefit states and municipalities, that would benefit the holders of municipal bonds. And it's very apparent that the Joe Manchins and the Kristen Sinemas and the John Testers of the world want to maintain that focus and maintain moderation in terms of the composition of any fiscal stimulus and avoid igniting further the inflation that the fiscal stimulus thus far has inflamed. And I think that there's a recognition of that we can't just throw money at people, because that is exactly what caused inflation, because the Fed was trying to cause inflation for nearly 20 years and failed. It wasn't until you directly deposited money into people's checking accounts that true inflation was ignited.
Yeah, I was going to just say, in your opinion, what is different this time? And I think the Fed was caught by surprise with the inflation that rose. I mean, last time they started quantitative easing, which was during the financial crisis, we didn't have inflation. This time we did. And I think you hit upon the difference there. This time, the government actually put money in people's pockets to spend.
That is right. And they put money in households with the greatest propensity to spend pockets. And now we have seen a full round trip in the level of savings held by U.S. households to pre-pandemic levels. In other words, a lot of money that went into the wind that has not necessarily increased the cushion of your average U.S. household in the event that the economy slows anew. Again, with the GOP in it to win it and out for blood, to use to mix metaphors, with the midterms coming, and I don't think they're going to back down from that, even if we see appreciable signs that the economy is slowing. So this is not a good backdrop for the Democratic Party or the Federal Reserve. But remember, this is a bed that they made. They're lying in it now, and they're not enjoying it.
And as we go forward, I don't know if we're going to see the kind of cycle where we had, I'm thinking of 2015, where basically they were raising interest rates a quarter of a point a year before Powell came in there and then start raising them even more. Do they even get that far? Last time, they only got to 2.5 on the Fed funds rate. I don't think they get that far this time. Do you?
No, I think the 60 basis point, 0.6 percentage differential between the 2 and the 10-year Treasury yield tells you that they get exactly 2 in this time and no more than that.
And if the economy does slow down, or if the markets do crash, or if we do go into recession, what do they do next?
as I just said, the only thing that they can possibly do is say that we will use all of the tools at our disposal at the zero bound, which is the Fed's balance sheet, and or possibly going further out the spectrum. But again, during a midterm election year, when you need congressional authority to take these steps and saying, okay, maybe this time we'll buy stocks directly, like the Bank of Japan, like the Swiss National Bank. But there are stipulations in the legislation that was passed in December of 2021 that dictate that the Fed does not have legal authority to simply reopen those lines of credit, effectively using the Treasury's balance sheet to come to the rescue of the credit markets as they did in March of 2020.
What really strikes me here is the dilemma that investors are going to find themselves. You mentioned a bunch of people retired. Maybe they had $500,000 in their 401k, and now they're waking up to the reality of low interest rates in an overvalued stock market. Not a good scenario to start your retirement with.
No, it's not. And the good news for people who are in kind of that sweet spot between 55 and 70 years old is that U.S. employers, let's just say they've been exhausted by the entitled attitude of post-pandemic workers who are in the workforce, as in, I need off Monday, I need off Friday. I don't really need any strictures if I am going to be in the office on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And if anything happens in the world at all, I go back to working from home 24/7. So I think that U.S. employers would appreciate the work ethic of older generations returning to the workforce. The risk here is, of course, that we have indeed seen evidence in the way companies have been spending money, that it's been invested towards IT, artificial intelligence, robotization, automation. So rather than build out their workforces, there's been a lot more of, let's make sure we don't need as many workers going forward.
So given the circumstances that we are, I want to go back to what you started this conversation with is basically no one knows when we're talking about rate hikes. As an investor right now, what would you be doing?
Well, I did mention those municipal bonds. And, you know, Joe Manchin is on the wires as we speak saying that Build Back Better is dead. That's a quote, dead, and needs to start all from new, take it all the way down to the studs. And that tells me that if Joe Manchin's in the driver's seat, and he was the one who was in the driver's seat, and that will benefit states, localities, and municipalities, when you have some of the world's most successful investors saying, please don't take shame in holding cash or larger percentages of cash than you normally would. I listen to these people and I pay attention to true shelters from the storm because people have a very little understanding that real estate is a pro-cyclical asset class in times of market disruption, which should be intuitive given if you're in Greenwich, Connecticut, you can name your price. Whereas 2.5 years ago, you were sitting there saying, am I ever going to sell my home? So we've obviously seen a rush into real estate. So it shouldn't surprise anybody that even though it's a quote unquote hard asset, that it has a lot of risk built in because whenever there's a rush in, there can be a rush out.
So municipal bonds look attractive to you. What about the stock market itself?
I am not exposed to the stock market. I do have exposure to individual companies on an angel funding basis. I have certainly not sold my gold and I am sitting on more cash than I otherwise would. And I'm enjoying my oil royalties very much enjoying my oil royalties.
Oh, it's a good time to be in energy. Danielle, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at Quill, tell them how they can do so, please.
Come visit quillintelligence.com and hop on a trial subscription. Reach out to our sales and happy to have them and put you on for a 2-week free trial subscription. And if you don't follow me on Twitter, well, your life is just about to get a lot more interesting. Find me at DeMartino Booth and follow me there as well.
All righty. Danielle, all the best. Thank you for coming on the program.
The credit markets are still suggesting caution on the equity outlook, and that was the main message by our CIO, Chris Poplava, on Monday's weekly video update. That certainly played out in this week's trading with a big sell-off in the tech-heavy NASDAQ and further signs of what appears to be a topping formation in the major indices. Felix Zuloff and Tom McClellan both warned on our show late last year that stocks were peaking, and so far, we have seen that hold true. Chris, before you get into some of the charts and data that you are looking at right now, I do want to note that you warned multiple times late last year, particularly in December when markets peaked, that listeners may want to raise some cash and get more defensive, as we were doing at our firm, given the building cautionary signs. Four items that you specifically cited at the market top for downside risks heading into this year were: one, a large cluster of Hindenburg omens across nearly every major index. The last time we saw that was in February of 2020, just before the COVID crash. Number two, global central bank tightening outside of the U.S., which is pointing towards slower economic growth. Number three, a sharp decline in global money supplies. And number four, something that we'll be diving into a bit more today, was a widening divergence between the stock market and the credit markets, showing that financial stress was increasing under the surface, even though the stock market was hitting all-time highs. That's something that we typically see right at market tops. So given all that, what you had to say late last year was, of course, spot on, as was the call to raise cash, get defensive, and pare back on long-term bonds, given the expected spike in yields that we have now seen take place. And I should also point out that we have been overweight the energy sector, given our bullish outlook on oil, and as Jim warned last year, to expect a quick return back to $100 a barrel, if not even possibly higher. On the day that you and I are speaking, West Texas crude is now trading at $92. So given that backdrop, what is your outlook on the market currently?
As a firm, we've been overweight energy probably since the spring of 2021. So definitely overweight for quite some time. And the big reason for that was simply looking at supply and demand. You know, we've got an administration, the Biden administration, which is obviously pro-green with the green agenda. Even the financial industry as a whole, you know, you're not really seeing lending by the investment banks to energy companies for expansion and production. You're also seeing activist investors getting on the boards of companies like Exxon to discourage them from production. In internationally, you'll get Royal Dutch and the mandate from the government to curtail fossil fuel production and move more towards green. Same thing with British Petroleum. So, you know, the whole world is really moving away from supporting the increase in production of oil and natural gas, which, when you think about it, unless we increase production, we're going to have increased demand. I mean, you look at the global economies recovering, the U.S., everyone else is recovering, that you're going to need more fuel. And just look at what the problem that you're seeing last year in Europe and in the U.K. with surging natural gas prices. You know, I think they're up something like 700% in last year. I think that's an understatement. And so for us, you know, seeing the writing on the wall that we're not going to see an increase in production and yet we're going to see an increase in demand, we decided to overweight energy and really juxtaposed to, 15 or so years ago. You look at where the sector energy is for the S&P 500, I believe in 2008, when oil was hitting about $150 a barrel, that energy was roughly, I think, 14% of the S&P 500, give or take. As of today, energy is only 3.5%. It is very tiny. And so, you know, our firm being overweight energy, I mean, you could have a 7% allocation to your stock portfolio in energy and you're double the S&P. So it's not really hard to be overweight energy. But, you know, we held that. Even, you know, during the correction in the middle of last year when commodities and oil corrected, you know, we remained bullish because of our long-term conviction in the supply-demand dynamic that we are going to see for the foreseeable future. You know, that we're really benefiting from that. I mean, it's astounding, but, you know, year-to-date, the energy sector is up 24% year-to-date. And you look at the market, for example, the S&P 500 is down 6%. And you look at the tech sector is down nearly 9.5%. So we're talking nearly a 34% performance difference between the tech and energy sector. And we think that's going to continue. You know, we might see a pullback in energy, but we still think there's going to be some more gains ahead for the sector.
So again, as you warned late last year, investors may want to start raising some cash, getting defensive. These were the things that we were doing at that time as the market was peaking, given those four things that I highlighted. We did post charts of all of those on our website and we're highlighting these as they were taking place. Let's stick to the fourth and final point that you started really warning about clearly late last year. And that was what we were seeing in the credit markets with that wide divergence between stocks hitting all-time highs as the credit markets were breaking down or diverging with the message of the stock market. Where do things stand today, given the big drop that we've now seen, like you said, you know, with the S&P down, I think, 6% year to date, the NASDAQ down almost 10%. What is the message coming from the credit markets currently?
Yeah, I think in terms of an overall strategy, our firm follows a weight of the evidence approach. So, you know, when the evidence is all skewed to one side, we will get very aggressive. You know, one of the things I think is different about our firm compared to our competitors is we're not buy and hold, you know. So, you know, across our asset allocation objectives, we have a neutral position and we can go above that with a greater allocation to risk assets or below that. And so when we see a uniform message of the markets, whether that's a bullish message, we'll be overweight risk assets, or if we're seeing a universally bearish message, we'll be underweight risk assets. And when the picture's mixed, that's where we're going to kind of dial back in closer to kind of benchmark hugging and be neutral. But for us, we started to see in the fall of last year the uniform bullish picture for the market beginning to diverge. And really what I was noticing in the final couple of months of the year was, you know, it's kind of a legendary investor Bob Farrell's rule number 7. Markets are strongest when they are broad and weakest when they are narrow to a handful of blue chip names. And to me, that really, really describes what we saw late in 2021. It was also what we saw for the bulk of 2018, where the market was rallying, hitting new highs, but the average stock was not participating. And one of the things that I take a look at is the Hindenburg omen, which essentially is looking at a certain threshold of stocks hitting new highs and new lows at the same time. Now, if you're in a bull market, you would expect to see new highs. You wouldn't expect also to see new lows. That wouldn't make sense. And conversely, if you're in a bear market, you wouldn't expect to see new highs associated also with new lows. And so when you see both of them at the same time, often at times it is signifying a trend that's about to change. And we saw it in 2018 and we saw that again last year. And I measure it across stock-only indices. That way, I'm not looking at mutual funds. I'm not looking at bond funds or other types of investments in securities. I'm looking at just operating companies only. And so I apply the Hindenburg omen rules to the S&P 500 large cap, the S&P 400 mid cap, S&P 600 small cap index, as well as some other broad ones like the Russell 3000, as well as the NASDAQ composite, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And what I was seeing was a whole host of Hindenburg's omens, which have often marked corrective periods or major market tops. And in light of seeing that, as well as seeing some divergence beginning in the credit markets, meaning credit spreads were starting to diverge a little bit from the markets, but it was mostly the lack of strong breath that I was seeing in the stock market that was causing us to raise cash. We also felt that the whole notion, which, you know, listeners to our segment will know that we discussed last year, that we really disagreed with the Fed's transitory comments, which, you know, the Fed has kind of come full circle. And obviously, they've removed transitory from their lexicon. But our feeling was that the Fed was going to have to get religion, and they were going to have to catch up to the curve at some point from being behind the curve. And we've seen that when you look at the markets in terms of what they're pricing in. Early last year, I think the market was pricing in the first rate hike in 2023, so nothing in 22. And then as time progressed, in the middle of last year, I think the market was pricing maybe one rate hike. And then as we got into the late fall, the market was pricing in two. And fast forward to where we are today, the market's pricing 5 rate hikes for this year. And the Fed is also discussing a reduction in their balance sheet. So I think the Fed has a lot more catching up to do. The market started to correct to discount this, but, you know, the Fed hasn't even raised one time. So the market really doesn't know the strength of conviction the Fed has behind tightening this year to rein in inflation. You know, we've been having the Fed put for the last decade, where essentially any sign of weakness, the Fed comes to the market's rescue. So, you know, you're starting to see the market trying to form a bottom. And some people think, you know, the market's done correcting, but I would disagree with that. One of the things that I discussed on our Monday investment meeting was that the credit markets were not recovering to the same extent of what we saw in the stock market. So the stock market started to rally late Friday, which carried over and spilled into this week. But, you know, looking at today where things stand, you know, the S&P did pull back yesterday. It's recovering a little bit today, but it's off its lows. I think the lows were roughly just under 4,400. You know, the market's over 4,500 right now on the S&P 500. But when I look at credit default swaps, essentially, this is what bond investors are paying for insurance to insure their bond portfolios or bonds against default. And there's indices that basically measure the aggregate cost of insurance for investment-grade bonds or junk bonds. And I look at both of those indices for credit default swaps for investment-grade and junk. And we started to see those indices begin to tick up, which means investors were starting to price in greater levels of default, and the markets were requiring more money to insure against that because that risk was rising. And so we started to see that really begin to move up as soon as we started 2022, the first day of trading. And what I noticed was that we ultimately saw a peak in credit default swaps last week, just as the stock market was bottoming. However, this week, we've seen a rally in the stock market spill over from last week. But when I'm looking at credit default swaps today, they're actually breaking out to new one-year highs. So we are clearly seeing a major divergence between the stress that is building and rising in the credit markets versus what we're seeing in the stock market. And I think a lot of that is the recovery in tech stocks with some explosive earnings from Microsoft, Google, as well as Amazon. We did have some disappointing earnings from Facebook, but by and large, you know, Amazon alone is pushing the entire consumer discretionary sector, you know, at the time you and I are speaking, up almost 4.5% today. So I do think that we are not done correcting. I think it's too soon to declare a bottom. And my assumption and feeling is that we probably won't have a bottom until late this month going into March. And so for clients, we are below neutral in terms of our risk exposure. So we're underweight stocks. We're also underweight bonds. You know, there is the risk of rising interest rates, which we were expecting. And so we're underweight bonds as well as underweight stocks. We have a fair amount of cash for our clients. And our plan is when we renew another leg down, which I think will probably start next week, we'll be looking for opportunities to increase exposure to risk assets. And in particular, I think we'll be dealing with a major market top in the dollar. I know that's something that you've been discussing with some of the guests you've had on the podcast. That's our house view as well, that the dollar will have a major peak at some point this year. And so we want to start looking at exposure to anti-dollar plays, obviously commodities, which we already have some exposure to. But even foreign equities, I think, could have a good opportunity for strong returns this year.
Chris, I'm not sure if many of our listeners realize this, or depending on how long they've been following our work on Financial Sense, but I mean, going back to the 2007-2008 market top, I remember at the time that you warning about major downside risks ahead that were brewing given what you're looking at the credit markets. So with that said, you know, the credit markets are obviously a very valuable tool to watch for strategists, as you said, to know the degree of risk that they should be taking in the stock market. What is it about the credit markets in particular that gives them that value?
I think the reason why I follow the credit markets so much is I feel like they tend to be less emotional than the stock market. I mean, how many mom and pop investors are able to invest in credit default swaps? I mean, they may not even know what those mean. So, you know, when you look at the credit markets, I feel that it's more institutional investors, kind of insiders to see what's going on in the market, who kind of have a real handle, you know, pulse on the financial markets and where things stand. And it's often the credit markets that seize before even the equity market. You know, I remember in 2008, calls for, you know, major buying opportunity in stocks with the stock market already down from the peaks in 2007. There's a lot of value investors who got caught in value traps arguing, you know, to purchase financials. But, you know, just kind of looking at history, one of the articles I wrote in 2007 was that the financial sector would be to the future bear market what tech was to the last. And you just have to simply look at where were the excesses. And they were clearly in the financial industry, in housing, and so they would have the biggest impact. But what I was noticing was even we had a pretty decent spring of 2008 rally, but I was not seeing it in the credit markets. The credit markets were not healing. In fact, they were getting worse, and the stress was building greater and greater, you know, almost like a volcano that's getting ready to erupt with, you know, building energy before it explodes, or an earthquake. You know, I was seeing that significant divergence. And when I look at where we are today, to bring everyone up to speed, again, you know, you look at the S&P, it's up from last Friday when the market bottomed. When you look at credit default swaps, they've actually gotten worse. So we have more stress in the credit system right now than where we did last Friday. And yet, looking at the stock market, you wouldn't think that. You know, the S&P has rallied several hundred points off the lows from last week. So this is why I feel that this is a head fake. You know, I think people are getting sucked in with the rally that we've seen in tech, thinking we're done. I don't. I think we're going to continue to correct. And I believe that the market, stock market, is going to do what the credit markets did. So, you know, my forecast, at least in terms of the message I'm reading from the credit markets, is we should probably expect the S&P to take out the lows from last Friday. So that's kind of why I think, you know, at least for us and our clients, we remain in cash. You know, we bought a few convertible debt, and we've taken advantage of the weakness on the fixed income side. And there's a lot of convertible bonds have gotten hit with the decline in the underlying stock. And so, you know, where we're able to pick them up, we're picking them up at discounts on the dollar and able to lock in some pretty decent yields to maturity over the coming years here, which I think will be better than what we'll get in you know, the bond benchmark. But on in terms of equities, we haven't pulled the trigger yet. Because again, I think the stock market is overly inflated, and I think we're heading lower.
So again, as you said, since spring of last year, we moved to an overweight in the energy sector, given our bullish outlook for oil. That has played out, and we still think that there's probably some upside ahead. We are underweight bonds. We're underweight the stock market more broadly, sitting on cash, waiting to deploy that. And you had said you referred to this as a head fake with this current rally that we've seen off the lows in that 4,400 region on the S&P 500. Would it be more accurate to characterize it as a right shoulder fake in that case, given it looks like we're putting in a head and shoulder top?
Definitely, depending on the indice that you look at. Typically, head and shoulders, you know, the top of the head to the neckline is the halfway point. And so if we fell roughly 10% from the highs, you know, it's projecting a possible 20% correction in the stock market.
If what you're saying when looking at the credit markets and the deterioration that we see in breadth, if that were to align with this head and shoulders top, technically speaking, we could be looking at another down leg of 10% from that low that we saw earlier this week. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's what, you know, a head and shoulders target would project. But, you know, we could go further than that. A lot of it's on sentiment, or, you know, maybe we don't go down that much. But for me, I do think at a minimum, we are going to take out last week's lows, because again, that's what the credit markets are telling me. But how much further below those lows we go, we're just going to have to see day by day.
I want to remind all of you listeners to make sure you watch each of our weekly updates that we do. Check those out on our website, on our video page, or on YouTube. Chris, with that said, I want to thank you for coming on again for another segment of Smart Macro. We will speak to you in another 2 weeks.
Sounds great, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any company. companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.